Hi, this is Marek Zabriskie, the Rector of Christ Church, Greenwich, and I'm joined today by Dr. Robert Waldinger, who is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and is director of the Harvard Study of Adult Human Development, and is also a practicing psychiatrist and a Zen master who travels around the world to teach meditation. And Andrew Boyer, my co-host here, and I will have a chance to engage Robert after an incredible forum where we had probably about 300 people come out to hear about the happiness study. So I wonder if we might just begin with that. Robert, if you could just, for people who don't know about this study, could you give us a little history and background about it?
Sure. As you said, it's called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. It's been going for 85 years. It's the longest study of the same people going through their lives that's ever been done. It began in 1938 with two groups, a group of Harvard College students and a group of inner city Boston boys from poor and disadvantaged families. And since then, we've brought in wives and children, so it's 724 families across 85 years.
And over the years, what kind of questions were you asking, you know, at the outset, not you, but you're the fourth, I think, person to lead it.
Right.
At the beginning, what were some of the key questions that they were asking to, derive information from? And then how did that evolve over time? What kind of questions are being asked today that might be different?
Well, we've studied the big domains of life, mental health, physical health, relationships, work life. But we've added methods. So we started out studying these things with interviews and physical exams and getting medical records from their doctors. But then eventually we added genetics, DNA, messenger RNA. We added brain scans to see how their brains reacted to different kinds of stimulation. We've stressed them out in our laboratory and looked at their cardiovascular reactivity and how quickly they recover from stress. So we've brought in these different methods.
This is a happiness study. And so how did you define happiness? Were there proxies that you had for happiness, or is it self-reported happiness? And also, like, do those line up? Do the proxies and the self-reporting line up?
Well, it isn't technically a happiness study. We've been called a happiness study. But to your point, we study the two big flavors of happiness that research shows us there are. So there's a kind of happiness called hedonic well-being, comes from hedonism, and it basically means, am I having fun right now, right? Am I getting pleasure? But then there's a kind of well-being called eudaimonic well-being, which is that sense of life being basically good, basically meaningful. That's that longer-term satisfaction kind of well-being. So we think about happiness of both kinds, and what we find is that people want some of both kinds of happiness. Some of us prioritize one kind over the other, and it's sometimes in our lives we prioritize one type of happiness over the other.
Does the absence of unhappiness, is that the same as happiness?
No. And in fact, I think about this a lot as a psychiatrist, because in mental health, we think, is it simply the absence of mental illness, which is a form of unhappiness? And no, what we find is that people can be in a state of what we call languishing. And a lot of people felt that during the pandemic, where there was nothing explicitly wrong, but they had no energy and they had no zest for life. And so what we really try to understand is not just how to prevent illness and how to prevent unhappiness, but what fosters thriving.
So you started in 1938, and are there just periods along the way where you've just stopped and said, we need to publish, here's what we found so far, or what are some of the key predictors of happiness? Or I like to often use the word joy, which is, I think of like
I love
more
that
extended
word.
Form of yeah. happiness. Happiness, yeah. I think, is like a volatile stock going up and down. Enjoy somehow coming more from within.
Yeah.
Versus happiness is, well, did you bring me my favorite dinner tonight or whatever it is? What are some of the key findings they had early on? And then as decades have passed, what are some other key findings that have started to just, you know, take people by surprise or catch them?
Well, one of the key findings early on was about health. that taking care of one's health turned out to be vital. Many of our people drank too much. So that was an era when it wasn't so much other drugs, it was alcohol that was the danger. And some of our people from both the privileged and the underprivileged groups became alcoholic, and we watched it ruin marriages. We watched it ruin lives. So, and that was at a time when, you know, drinking was a good man's failing. There were all these euphemisms that kind of minimized the role of alcohol in destroying our well-being. And so I think part of what now is obvious, but was not obvious in the 40s and 50s and 60s, was the toll that alcohol takes on individual lives and on families. And then we also looked at exercise before it was fashionable, because we found that some of the people in our study exercised regularly and they stayed healthier. They didn't develop the diseases of aging as early as the people who were more sedentary. This was before there was a lot of publicity about the importance of exercise, which really began more 70s maybe, but then 80s on. So we were kind of pioneers in that way.
Now, one of the big takeaways, we just came out of your lecture, so we know all this, but the audience listening to this podcast might not, that of your study was that personal connections are really the key to joy and happiness. And I was wondering, first, if you could kind of explain that at a basic level, but then also talk a little bit about, well, how many connections is ideal, and is it about having really close connections with one person or two people or what?
Yeah. Well, that was the surprising finding. When our original subjects got to be 80 years old, we said, okay, let's look back at what we knew about them when they were in their 50s, and let's see if we can predict who's going to be a healthy, happy 80-year-old and who's not going to be, or who's going to be dead. And what we found was that the strongest predictor at age 50 was not your cholesterol level or your blood pressure. It was how connected you were to other people. And then we began to look more broadly and found that the people who were most connected to others literally saw more people more frequently, and the people who had warm relationships stayed healthier, and they stayed healthier longer. And so it was literally that they were less likely to get coronary artery disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes. And initially, we were skeptical, but when many other research groups began to find the same thing, we began to understand that this was a powerful finding for all of us.
So the opposite of that is loneliness, right?
Yeah.
Isolation. What impact is that having on people's happiness and well-being?
It has a huge effect. We know that loneliness is now epidemic, and by that, I mean that one in three or one in four people in the U.S. will tell you that they feel lonely much or all of the time. This is based on good surveys. And what we find is that loneliness is a stressor. And so literally, people who are lonely have higher levels of stress hormones. They have immune systems that don't work as well. And their brains break down sooner, not just their bodies. So here we have a large segment of our population that's lonely, and the knowledge that that is a risk factor for poorer health as we get older.
And what group? I think it's the teens, isn't it? And, you know, young adults who self-report as the most lonely. Why do you think that is?
We're really trying to understand that, because everybody imagines that young adults are the happiest and having the most fun. It seems that young adulthood is a time of identity formation. So people ask, who am I? What kind of person am I? Who do I want to be? Who do I want to hang out with? And what we find is that isolation and fear of not measuring up to your own values or to other people's values, that those fears are at their height during adolescence and young adulthood. And they're particularly exacerbated by social media use. When we watch other people who look like they're happy all the time, many young people are susceptible to feeling worse about themselves, to having higher levels of depression and anxiety based on looking at other people's curated lives.
You know, it's so paradoxical because we all thought that the internet, like I was involved in the internet in the early days, like in 95 and 96, and we all thought, oh, that's going to bring the world together and it's going to, you know, make a lot of our differences go away. And it's done exactly the opposite. And I'm wondering, like, does that institutionally, like, is that, does it have to be that way? Was there a way to make the digital revolution actually grow us together? I mean, there's things like Meetup, which I like, which gets people in, but you know, what are you seeing in terms of actual solutions?
There's research on this. There's a psychologist named Jean Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E, and she studies how people use the digital world. And what she finds is that if people use social media to actively connect with other people, it actually increases well-being. So I have a friend who, during the pandemic, reconnected with some elementary school friends on Facebook, and they are so happy. They have coffee every Saturday morning, and they're thrilled. You know, that kind of active use and active reaching out for connection increases well-being. And what she finds then is that the passive use, where we doom scroll through other people's Instagram feeds, that's what lowers our well-being and makes us feel more isolated.
Doom scroll. I like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
we've all done it.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to parents or grandparents or teenagers who are listening to this about social media and the impact of it and how to maybe coach their children or grandchildren or themselves in terms of how to use it?
Yeah. Probably the best litmus test is to ask yourself or ask your child, okay, spend 15 minutes doing this thing on social media. And now let's just stop and see how you feel. Do you feel happier? Do you feel more open? Is your energy up? Or do you feel more down? Do you feel more kind of closed off, more isolated? And that is a litmus test each of us can take, right? Every time we use a piece of the internet. And I would say that might be one way to help ourselves and help kids figure out, okay, what is enlivening for me and what's the opposite?
Yeah, no, it's almost like what you described. You certainly get like a dopamine boost or a hedonic pleasure from the internet every time you use it. But then afterward, you feel like you've, you know, just wasted your time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also that FOMO feeling, that fear of missing out, right? That any of us can get, but particularly young people, you can go away feeling like everybody else is going to that great party and I'm not going.
Do you find any gender breakdown and difference there? Because someone said to me recently, it's much harder on girls because they are 24/7. Every photograph taken of you could be put on someone's internet feed, and you've got to be looking your best and looking happy. Guys can be slouching and, you know, looking like they just crawled out of bed, and they're not so bothered by that. But the gals, you know, if someone gets 85 likes and they get 3, there's an issue.
Exactly. And that, you know, what we do know is that it's harder on females. And there are a lot of reasons, probably the reasons you named. And the way we get socialized to be more attuned to what other people think, I think women are more socialized toward that. But what we do know is that teenage girls are the most vulnerable and that we have to be really careful of that. Boys also often will use social media to play video games. So they're like, you know, killing each other and plotting, you know, mutinies and things, you know, which is a different kind of vibe than just seeing who's doing what.
So this is Greenwich, the home of the hedge fund. And, and you know, what has your study revealed about the correlation between wealth and happiness?
What we have seen, and other studies have shown this, that we get happier as we make more money in order to meet our basic material needs, okay? So that means having food, having shelter, being able to educate our children, getting health care, those basic things. But that once we get beyond that, and some estimates a few years ago were $75,000 a year in the United States annual income, once we get above that, we don't get much of an increase in well-being at all, in happiness. Despite all the messages we get all day long that if you have a lot of money, you'll be happier. I work with people in psychotherapy who come in saying, I got to make a lot of money. And when I ask them, well, what's the money for? Many of them are clueless because the given is, well, money's just going to be the end in itself and it's going to make me happy. So there, we are selling each other myths that are really taking people away from the most important stuff. I don't have to tell this audience that, but it's important to keep naming it, right?
Yeah, well, one of the questions you must probably get a lot, because this was a Harvard study and then also a study of Harvard men and then also a study of other men who were from lower income and their results. But one of the two big questions obviously I had were, what about women? But then also, what about other cultures? Because like you're looking really at an American culture, and there are other cultures in which community is much more part of things. There are other cultures in which views on money are different.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I think Chinese is probably one of the more interesting ones. But like, what are you seeing in terms of happiness in other cultures and how it relates to community?
Well, I'm not studying it with our sample, but I am hearing about it a lot because of my work. And China's a good example. China has a traditional structure where everybody had a role in a family. I mean, grandparents had to be there to take care of grandchildren, and parents went out to work. China is now struggling with some of the things we've been struggling with, which is people leave their villages, they leave their extended families to seek economic opportunity. But what that means is that then they don't have childcare when they have children. Grandparents are without their traditional roles and purpose, and everybody is suffering tremendously. And India is seeing some of this same kind of shift.
Yeah, where's the happiest place on earth, or who has the happiest culture?
Well, there's this paradox, which is Scandinavian countries are the happiest, but they also have the highest suicide rates. So, and those don't have to be mutually exclusive, but it's complicated, as you know. Another place that's pretty happy is the Kingdom of Bhutan. And that's a place that, as you may know, is very much oriented toward collective well-being. Like, they don't think, am I living my best life? They think, what's important for the community? Not just my family, but all of us. And what they find is that communal orientation is hugely impactful on how meaningful people feel their lives are.
You note in your book that people are terrible about knowing what's good for them. Can you speak more about that? Because I do find that in counseling and meeting with people, sometimes you're thinking, what kind of choices are you making? Or what were you thinking? You know, if I marry this person who's a total fix-up project, I'm going to have a happy everlasting ending and everything. Not really.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how they get involved in addictions, et cetera. Why are people terrible about knowing what is good for them?
Well, one reason is that we try to move away from what's painful or unpleasant and toward what's pleasant. And so, you know, if you want the pain to go away, that's a strong driver of reaching for drugs or alcohol. I mean, many people start down the road of addiction just by trying to relieve anxiety or depression, you know? And so one of the things we know is that negative emotion and unhappiness is a driver of some of these terrible choices. Another thing is some fabulous person comes along who you see is really a fix-up project, but somebody can't see because it looks like the answer to all my prayers. and so what we're saying is we want to feel better. And so the question is, how do we find ways to help each other find those kind of solutions that involve squarely facing the unhappy parts of life and figuring out the healthy things we can do to deal with life's unhappiness, whether it's being single and not wanting to be, or whether it's being anxious when you walk into a room and not wanting to have to reach for a drink in order to feel okay about yourself. So there are a lot of complicated reasons why people make bad choices. But the other thing I talked about just in the last hour was this idea that we all have some resistance to reaching out to new people, to talking to strangers. And there have been some studies that show that actually most people don't think they're going to enjoy talking to strangers, but then when you do it, you're usually much happier. And so, you know, our listeners could try that today, right? You could try talking to the person who checks you out in the grocery store or someone you encounter and just see if it doesn't give you a little hit of well-being by the time you're done with a casual conversation.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you talked about was that one in four, was it Americans or one in four people in your...
Americans.
Americans didn't feel that they had anyone that they could talk to if something was really wrong or if they were sick or if they needed someone to talk to. And I was just wondering, what do we do about those people? Is that an institutional problem? Can we solve that in some way? And I imagine if you're one of those people, it's not easy for you to go and find somebody to even have a small interaction with. So how do you help those people?
Exactly. Some people are introverts, and so they don't feel comfortable reaching out to anyone or making friends. There's nothing wrong with being an introvert, but we often have to help introverts find at least one or two people who they can be connected with, and that may be all they need. But you know, the problem is that the causes of loneliness and social disconnection are multiple, and so there's no single remedy. I mean, I've actually reviewed the literature on this when they try to study this, and they find that for some people, it's a temperamental proclivity to stay isolated, and they actually give off vibes to other people that say, don't come near me. They don't mean to be giving off these vibes, but they often are. You can actually teach those people to be different in social situations. But there are other people who are socially isolated for, because their mother's raising tiny children and there's nobody around who they see. And so there's so many reasons.
I was also wondering, because you said you had people in your study, including JFK and the Boston Strangler. And I was thinking more about the Boston Strangler, but like, what did you see with people who had mental illnesses as they went through that study? Oh. Did some of them have happy lives? Like, how did it work out?
The people who had families that rallied around them and communities that rallied around them did much better with mental illness. And then our treatments for mental illness have gotten so much better in the last 50 years. So 85 years ago, we didn't have nearly as much to offer people who were struggling with mental illness as we do now. I mean, and it's, you know, one in five people has an episode of depression in their lifetime. So these are common, common problems. So I think that what we found in our study is that people who could rely on family and community, sympathetic, helpful family and community, and people who would get mental health care when they could, that those were the people who did by far better than the people who tried to suffer alone.
So you are a Zen master, and you travel the world teaching meditation. Have you found that to add to your happiness and well-being? And what does your study reveal about spiritual practices that individuals may have and whether that correlates to a sense of happiness and joy?
Yes. Yes, it has definitely increased my happiness. I was not raised in a Zen Buddhist household. I discovered Zen as an adult. But Zen, like most spiritual practices, are exercises in being more present to life. That's really it. It's like, what's here right now? And so what I found, and many people find, is that when they do engage in one of those spiritual practices, you know, it could be meditation, it could be prayer, it could be yoga, but that any of those practices that bring you into the present moment, where you face toward everything, the hard stuff, the sad stuff, not just the happy stuff, that ultimately creates more of a sense of kind of the basic okayness of life, even when life is hard. And that for me has been an amazing, asset, an amazing feature of my life now.
So do you ask any questions about folks about where they spend their mental focus? I always tell people, you can only be joyful in the present moment. You know, you can't be, well, when I get that corner office at the, you know, corporation, I'm going to be a happy camper. Or right. If I could only go back to, you know, the New Jersey shore as a child, you know, or something, that's gone.
Yeah.
But do you ask questions about where people's mental framework is? And do you find that those who live in the present moment tend to be happier than those who are always reminiscing or those who are always looking forward?
Oh, yes. And actually, we know that both from spiritual practice, and you know it, you know, from your ministry, right? But we also know it from empirical research, that we are thinking about other things, the present or the past or the future, more than half the time, and that we are happier when we are in the moment. So one of the things that makes us happier, for example, is these states that we call flow. So what's flow? Flow is being in that state where you're just involved in something. You lose awareness of time. You're just in it. It could be playing a game of chess. It could be skiing down a ski slope. It could be anything, right? And so one of the things I often ask people is, do you have anything in your life that is that kind of flow for you, where you just are so in it that you lose yourself? And the people who have that or can find that experience joy as a part of that.
One of the things, and I can't remember exactly what the quote was, but you talked about intimacy and how valuable intimacy was. And how do you define that? And what is that, and how, why is it important?
That's a great question. So there's emotional intimacy, right? Where I feel like you know me, you know who I am, and I know you. That's a kind of emotional, personal intimacy. There's also just the day-to-day intimacy of living with someone. So one of the things we found was that in our couples, that often one spouse would die fairly soon after the other spouse died. And there was nothing mystical about it. It was that there was nobody there to remind you to eat, to take your medicine, to get you off the couch and go take a walk, right? So what we find is that even that physical intimacy without emotional intimacy conveys this, some of these benefits. But certainly emotional intimacy makes us feel like we're connected, like we're seen, like we belong.
So you must have tracked, you know, countless marriages through this study. What have you found about marriage and happiness and where the happiest marriages are, maybe?
Yeah. The happiest marriages were the marriages where people allowed each other to change and helped each other with change and helped each, celebrated those changes. So rather than trying to freeze partners as they were when they got together, for example, wait, I didn't sign up for you to do this, that the happiest couples understood that each of us develops throughout adulthood and to welcome that rather than resisting it. I'll give you an example. Like my wife, I wasn't involved in Zen when we got married, and she, like, where did this come from? And similarly, she was not a musician when we got married, and now she's an avid pianist. So what we've tried to do is support each other. She's a huge supporter of my going away for Zen retreats, even hosting them in my home. I'm a big supporter of her having practice time every day with her music. And I think rather than stopping and saying, I don't want you to be like this, the happiest marriages were the marriages where there was acceptance and curiosity as people move through life.
You know, one of the things you also talk about a lot is, you know, cortisol and stress, and how you spoke about how the presence of intimacy or community helps reduce that. And without that, with loneliness, it doesn't get reduced and it's dangerous. Is there a physiological thing? Is it oxytocin? What is the interaction that's happening that's causing the cortisol to go down? Or is it unknown?
That's a great question. There are a lot of things, you know, it's complicated, as you can imagine. One of the things we know is that the nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, the part that calms us down, when it's functioning well, we can calm down when a stimulus is removed. And so you know, if I'm upset about something, or even if I'm feeling lonely and then I take a walk and I don't feel lonely anymore, how long does the agitated state stay in my body? And so we look at parasympathetic nervous system functioning as a way to see how good the equipment is to calm me down.
So when you look at, because you're a psychiatrist, chemical balance or imbalance, DNA and genetics, and also just the family you were raised in, the, you know, if you were a child in the Gaza Strip right now or in the bordering area in Israel and been traumatized on either side or in the Ukraine, does that just vastly lower your ability to probably have a happier life? And how much do genetics and chemical balance play?
Ooh. So, such great questions. So what we know is there's a level of stress that's called toxic stress for young people, for children. They've studied this at the Harvard Center for the Developing Child, where you have overwhelming trauma. And the stress reactions in the body really change the brain, not just the body. And the question is, do they change the brain irrevocably? And what the findings are is that many of these people can never fully recover, ever, but that their recovery part of the way is possible if we get these children into safe places, if we treat them well, if as adults they find people who treat them well. So what we want is to prevent this kind of toxic stress at all costs, right? Like what is happening now in the Middle East is terrible for our future. Right, because we are creating a generation of traumatized people, children, and so what we haven't gotten good at is understanding. Okay, well, exactly, what are the parts that get damaged that don't ever recover, and is there anything we can do about that? So there's a lot of interest in this, and obviously in this thing we call resilience, which is being able to recover. But what we do know is that full recovery for many children is impossible.
Hmm. We call this show The Calling, and one of the things we usually like to ask, you have so many things that you know about that are interesting, it's almost, don't want to spend too much time on it, but what was it, when did you know that this was your calling to tackle this subject? Was there a time in your life where you said, okay, now this is what I want to be, I'm going to go down this path?
Well, there wasn't one moment. I studied history as a college kid, and then I was really interested in what made people tick, so I went into psychiatry. But then at one point, my predecessor, George Valiant, the third director, took me out to lunch and said, how would you like to inherit this study? And at first I thought, maybe I don't want to because it's big and messy and intimidating.
And it's forever.
And it's forever. and I
said, death do us part.
I'm not sure I want to do this. And so then what happened was he said, come to my office and read through two people's stories. Read through, just flip through their files. And I did that. And I started with age, 19. And I read what this guy said about himself as a 19-year-old kid at Harvard. And then I read about him at 40, and then I read just what he was saying about his life, and I was just completely hooked. And that was what did it. It was reading the individual life stories that made me say, yeah, I want to devote my time to this.
How good did you get it sort of when you read the kids when they're 7 or they're 19 or whatever, and then how good are you able to sort of predict that they're going to have a happy life or that they're going to be successful or...
We were and we weren't. So there were lives where you could sort of see, we used to call it a red thread, this kind of theme that would continue through someone's life, of happiness, of unhappiness, disconnection, whatever. But then there were other lives where there were pivots on a dime in all directions. And so in our book, we have a chapter, the last chapter is called It's Never Too Late. And we have these real stories of people who, who were isolated and didn't feel good about their lives. And then the one man in his 60s found a group of friends at his gym. And he said, for the first time in my life, I have real friends. And they started socializing together, and he felt like he belonged for the first time. So the bottom line is, yes, you can see some lives that have paths that are somewhat predictable, and then, boy, are there lives that surprise you.
And when you look at all these lives, do you find, because our show is called The Calling, the people who found their calling, their thing in life, their passion, are they, you know, where they say, you know, I get paid to do this, but I do it for free. I like it so much.
Yeah.
Do you find that folks who found that thread in life, that calling, that is a purpose bigger than themselves, do they generally tend to be much happier?
Yes, they do. And there's other research that finds this, that when people have, you know, what we say is a reason to get up in the morning, like this is why I do what I do, that those people are happier, and that it's possible to find that. And you know, you probably know this from your work, but, you know, there are ways of clarifying what I most care about, and then what can I do about that? So, you know, maybe I don't have a job that I feel like I would do this for free. You know, some people are lucky. I love my job, but many people don't have those kinds of jobs. And yet, in our study, many of those people were still able to find passion, you know, what they cared about. You know, it might have been mentoring young kids. It might have been teaching kids to play soccer. It could have been anything. And it doesn't have to be their primary occupation.
And my final question, we talked a little about Robert Putnam and, you know, Bowling Alone, and you said he had kind of an optimistic view in his new book. Like, what's your view of this? Is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse? What do we need to change?
Well, it depends on what we do, right? And what Robert Putnam, I think, is arguing, his book is called The Upswing, and he argues that there have been times before in history where we've been more divided from each other, and that from the ground up, there are social movements that say we have to change this, and they do change it. And I think the question is, are we in a situation where we can do that? The worry is that we're so divided from each other that this is going to be harder than in the past. But is there some way that we can say we are going to opt out of this division thing, and we're going to try to find what we have in common? I mean, one of the things about studying these lives is that you look at how much every human being has in common.
Right.
And it's so much greater than all these superficial differences that our politicians manipulate us into making so much of, right? And so how do we get ourselves to come back to that recognition of, wait, you know, we are so much on the same page, and we're not allowing ourselves to know that.
Is artificial intelligence helping you mine this data and information at all, or is that not work?
We're using it a bit. So, for example, just the fact that we scanned every piece of paper in our study. We had hundreds of thousands of documents, and we got a grant to scan them all into searchable PDFs. So now my computer can search 100,000 pages for every time the word mother is used. Like, and we're finding things we didn't even know we had, right? Because we're for the first, I would have to flip through those pages to search in the past, and now my computer can do it like that, right? Now, that is technically artificial intelligence. What I don't know is whether we can use some of the more sophisticated, you know, generative artificial intelligence things in what we do. I don't know yet.
Yeah. So Christmas is coming and Santa's on the way. And I want to just close with this question. You talked about, you know, discretionary money and things like that. When people want something for Christmas or want to give something to someone, what is your advice about the best way to either give or receive happiness? Is it go buy me that sweater, or is it let's take a trip together, or let's go to see this Broadway show? Is it an experience or a purchase?
It's an experience. That's what the research shows, that we are happier when we give each other experiences. So I've started for my kids. So I've grown kids. So when they say, Dad, what do you want for Father's Day? I say, I want to go out to dinner with you all by ourselves and have an evening together. And that has been so much more fun than whatever they would go pick out for me in a store.
What a great note to end on. Fantastic. Thank you so much, yeah. Dr. Waldinger. This has been great. Thank you, Andrew. And yeah. We thank all of you for joining us on The Calling.